I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. It's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is being manufactured here in Baltimore, has been approved for use, adding an important weapon in the fight against the coronavirus. Unlike the vaccines made by Pfizer and Moderna, the J&J drug requires only one dose, so it's much easier to administer. The company is promising 100 million doses by June and a billion by the end of the year. Just under 14% of Marylanders have been inoculated against the virus as of today. More than twice as many white people have been vaccinated than black people. Only about 4% of those vaccinated so far have been Latino. We'll talk virus, variants, and vaccines with Dr. Lena Wen after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a good weekend. Thanks so much for being with us. The COVID-19 vaccine developed by Johnson & Johnson has been approved for emergency use authorization by the FDA and recommended by the CDC for people over the age of 18. The J&J vaccine is a one-dose drug. It's expected to be put into use as early as this week, and it will give a huge boost to U.S. efforts to inoculate enough people to achieve what's known as herd immunity. As evidence grows that the number of highly transmissible variants of the virus is increasing across the country. M&T Bank Stadium has opened as a mass vaccination site in downtown Baltimore. The Baltimore Sun reports that in response to a question from a reporter about whether or not any of the vaccine doses allocated for the new site would be reserved for city residents, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said the state's largest city had been getting more doses of COVID-19 immunization than it was entitled to. This drew a swift and angry response from Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott and other city leaders. Some of the allocation at the Six Flags mass vaccination site in Prince George's County have been set aside for local residents. Scott thinks the same should be the case here in Baltimore. Today on Midday, it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen, an emergency physician, former Baltimore City Health Commissioner. Dr. Wen teaches at the George Washington University School of Public Health. She's also a columnist for the Washington Post and a medical analyst for CNN. Dr. Wen joins us on Skype. Hi, Lena. How you doing? Welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. It's always good to talk to you.
And listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Wen, and I would imagine that several of you will, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. So, Lena, I want to talk first about this issue of inequity in those people who are receiving the vaccines. And it comes down, I think, on a certain level to an argument between whether or not the problem is accessibility for people of color or hesitancy on the part of people of color about getting the vaccine. What do we know? What is the data saying about who's getting it and why white people are getting it in such higher proportions than people of color?
Well, right now we know that we have a big problem of inequitable outcomes. And that is that white Marylanders, for example, are getting vaccinated at twice the rate of black Marylanders. And people of Latino heritage here in Maryland account for only 4%, as you said in the opening, of individuals receiving either first or second doses of the vaccine. So that's what we know about the outcomes. You ask an important question about what is the reason for it. And here's the thing. Right now, demand far outstrips supply across the board, across Maryland, across the country. At some point, vaccine hesitancy probably is going to be the limiting factor. That is not the limiting factor right now. And the reason why I joined two fellow former health commissioners, Josh Sharfstein and Peter Bielenson, in writing an op-ed in the Post this weekend about this issue is, so often, it's really infuriating to hear hesitancy being used as the excuse for why people of color, people in low-income communities are not getting the vaccine, when actually we know that the real problem right now is access. I mean, you look at how cumbersome and how difficult the scheduling system in Maryland is, even for people who have extraordinary means, people who have relatives and friends who could be calling on their behalf and trying to schedule appointments on their behalf. It's really difficult to get through. Then there are additional barriers of finding transportation, finding time off from work, et cetera, to actually get these vaccines. We need to be fixing this issue of access first. And I think attributing the lack of vaccination in certain populations to hesitancy is a way to blame individuals rather than to fix the systemic problems that are where we are.
And should, for example, the allocation that's given to the mass vaccination site at M&T Bank Stadium here in Baltimore have a certain percentage of those doses sequestered, allocated specifically for people who live in the city? I understand that's what they're doing in Prince George's County at the Six Flags site. Do you think that's a good approach?
I certainly think that that is the kind of approach that we need to be doing a lot more of. Even if it's not a percentage set aside, you could also say for the first day of the sign-up, the only people who can sign up in that first day are Baltimore City residents, and then also enlist community groups, who I know that many informal church community groups are already really involved in these efforts to get out the word, have them know about the vaccine signups in advance so that they can reach the communities. I think there are a number of other things that, again, Josh Sharfstein, Peter Bielenson, and I laid out in this article. For example, scaling up the work that the health department, the Baltimore City Health Department, is already doing with mobile door-to-door outreach. I think that's really important. Also, getting vaccines not only to these mass vaccination sites, but also to community pharmacies, to federally qualified health centers that are located in areas of highest need. Having transparency is also really important because we want to see who's getting vaccinated at what site, where do they live? And if we find out that certain communities are not getting outreach, perhaps it's time for us to do that kind of door-to-door outreach to reach people where they are. And then another element that we really need to address, and I think you had mentioned, Tom, about Governor Hogan's, I think, rather unfortunate comment, an inaccurate comment about how Baltimore is somehow getting more than our fair share or more than we're entitled to, whatever words that was using. You know, one of the problems is we are counting hospital allocation against the Baltimore City's total. And that's just not right because Baltimore City, as you know, we have 11 acute care hospitals. And when you give doses to hospitals, hospitals are using it for their employees, for their patients, many of whom are not Baltimore City residents. So just to be clear, the issue is not that we should not be, you know, I'm not saying don't give doses to hospitals. Obviously, hospitals are a great hub for distribution. Many people trust their hospital or health system. The problem is we need to be counting the vaccine doses the right way. We should be counting who is getting the doses from the hospitals who are Baltimore City residents, not counting the total allocation given to hospitals in some way that actually counts against the city.
There's a piece in the New York Times about military personnel who have been offered the vaccine. And in particular, they are finding a good deal of hesitancy among younger military personnel. The military is not yet requiring, in other words, ordering military personnel to take the vaccine. They did do that, for example, in the case of anthrax 10 or 12 years ago, 20 years ago, when an anthrax vaccine came out, they required everybody taking it, even people who didn't want to have it for whatever reason. There were some 400 court-martials about that, or 400 disciplinary actions, and some 900,000 people in the military were given the anthrax vaccine. When it comes to that kind of thing, and I guess the reason the military is not requiring it right now is because it's only been approved for emergency use authorization. It's not been approved as a standard drug. But once these vaccines do reach that level where they are approved as a sort of regular drug, it's very likely that the military will require people to take the vaccine. Where do you stand on you know, organizations, not just the military, but even employers saying, you know, look, we're going to reopen the office or reopen the store, but you can't come back to work unless you've been vaccinated. What role do private entities have in demanding, requiring that people are vaccinated before they are back to work?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think there are two parts to the answer. One is that we're nowhere near that right now. And that's because supply is the limiting factor. You can't require for people to be vaccinated when there's no way for them to be. And that would be discriminatory because you can't say only people who are vaccinated are able to come back to work, but a lot of people cannot be vaccinated. So we are a pretty long way off from having that be even in consideration because of the limited supply. At some point, though, we are going to have enough supply. And as you said, Tom, we are going to have the vaccine not only be authorized for emergency use, but actually approved to reach that a formal approval. And then I think at that point, there is a long precedent of requiring vaccines. School kids are required to have vaccines before coming back to school. Healthcare workers, I mean, I'm required. Healthcare workers are required to have flu shots, to have hepatitis B shots and other things to protect ourselves and our patients. And I could imagine for the case of COVID-19 that businesses may actually see it in their interest to require it not only of their their employees, but also potentially of customers. One could imagine that potentially for cruise ships, as an example, that they would be allowed to operate sooner if they say everybody who's on this cruise ship is vaccinated. You could imagine that maybe individuals might feel safer going on a cruise ship that has such type of rule. And I, again, it's hard to project into the future. I think we need to have a lot of humility in terms of projecting what may happen. But I would anticipate if the vaccines continue to prove, as they have, to be safe, effective, if we continue to have the kind of supply that we are hopeful to have coming into the spring and summer, I could imagine that there are incentives aligned such that private industry begins to increase the carrots, if you will, so that it's not so much by force and by mandate that people are getting the vaccine, but rather because so many different freedoms are open up to individuals who are getting the vaccine. That's the incentive for people to do so.
You yourself, Dr. Nguyen, are a participant, a subject in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine trial. Can you explain to us how the Johnson & Johnson approach to vaccination inoculation differs from the other two that we're familiar with, the Pfizer and Moderna? They are what's called mRNA vaccines. Johnson & Johnson is referred to as a viral vector vaccine. So it does its job in a different way. Can you give us a brief primer on how it works differently than the other two?
Sure. I think that the main takeaway message for Pfizer, Moderna versus the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is that they work to stimulate your immune system differently, but the end result is the same, which is that what you get when you take a vaccine is that it stimulates your immune system so that it is ready. The next time that it meets the coronavirus, the actual coronavirus, you have the antibodies, you have your immune system ready to go to fight that intruder, to fight the coronavirus. The way that Pfizer and Moderna work is different because it's being studied as a two-dose vaccine. So Pfizer and Moderna, you have first a primer dose and then you get a booster shot. And so those are spaced 3 weeks apart in the case of Pfizer, 4 weeks apart in the case of Moderna. And as you said, they use the mRNA platform. The platform that's used for Johnson & Johnson is an inactivated viral vector. So they use a cold virus, essentially, that is not active, and that is what's used in order to stimulate your immune system. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is studied as a one-dose vaccine. Actually, there's also a two-dose version that's being trialed as well. That's the arm of the study that I'm in, studying this two-dose version. But it is actually being studied also also specifically as this Windows version. The Windows version is the one that has already been authorized by the FDA as of this week. And so I think that's another key difference, is that with Pfizer, Moderna, you really have to get the two doses in order to get the immune protection that's needed. The Johnson & Johnson is a one and done, which I think many people might prefer because they might not want to, or for whatever reason, may not be able to go and find a second appointment. With Johnson & Johnson, the other advantage when it comes to distributing the vaccine is that, unlike, for example, the Pfizer vaccine that requires this ultra cold freezer storage, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine can be stored for months at refrigerated temperatures, which makes it something that that certainly has advantages for example, for doctor's offices, for community pharmacies that may not be able to store at such a low temperature. And I think my bottom line for all three of these vaccines is they are all safe and highly effective against preventing severe disease. And if you had told us a year ago, 6 months ago, or even a few months ago, that by now, by March 1st, that we would have three highly effective, safe vaccines against COVID-19, I think we would have all have said, wow, what a remarkable achievement. And that's what we should be saying now.
Dr. Lina Wen is a columnist for The Washington Post, a medical contributor for CNN, a public health scholar at George Washington University, one of the leading public health experts in the world, and a dear friend of our program here on Midday. To pose a question to Dr. Wen, you can send us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can call us, 410-662-8780. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a flash. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, a conversation with Republican legislative leaders in the Maryland General Assembly about their priorities in this year's session. My guests will be Republican Minority Leader Delegate Nick Kipke and Delegate Kathy Shalega, who is the Republican Minority Whip. I'll also check in with Avita Wiggins, who covers the General Assembly for the Washington Post. So I hope you can join us for our update from Annapolis tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Lina Wen, an emergency physician and visiting professor at George Washington University. She's also a former health commissioner in the city of Baltimore. Before we continue our conversation with Dr. Wen, let me give you this telephone number one more time. This is a phone number that is available for folks who don't have internet access, don't have a computer, and who need to find an appointment for a COVID-19 vaccine on the phone rather than online. The number is 855-MD-GO-VAX, 855-MD-G-O-V-A-X. So if you don't have a computer, you want to do this by telephone, call 1-855-MD-GO-VAX. And for folks who do have a computer, for folks who do have internet access, maybe there's somebody in your neighborhood, maybe an older person who doesn't have access to the internet or a computer. Maybe you could help that person out finding an appointment for a COVID-19 vaccine. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. So, Lina, we have a question from a listener about boosters. You mentioned that right before the break. She says, how will the need for boosters be established? Will it come from a surge in cases or genomic sequencing? And how long will it take to build a booster using the mRNA techniques with Pfizer and Moderna, or for that matter, the techniques that are employed in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? So when will we know whether or not boosters are necessary, and how long will it take for them to be made?
It's a great question, and I just wanted to make sure that I'm clear on a point. I had previously described the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine as the primer and the boost, right? So you do need, for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, you currently already need the two doses. That's how it's studied. You probably get some protection after one dose, but we don't know how much protection you have, how long it lasts. So that second dose is known as a boost in itself, but it is a required part of the two-dose regimen for Pfizer and Moderna. That's different than what the questioner is asking, which is about a separate booster shot. There are currently boosters being studied for Pfizer, Moderna. I believe that Johnson & Johnson is also studying this too, specifically to target the variants, these mutant strains that have started to arise that look like some of them may render the vaccines that we have less effective. It looks like they're still going to be effective, but they're going to be somewhat less than this extraordinary efficacy that we've seen with the vaccine thus far. And so Pfizer and Moderna are already studying this. It could be a matter of a couple months before these boosters are developed and tested. So it's something that that is actively being looked into. Now, as to when they're going to be needed, it's a question of when we see breakthrough infections. And what I mean is, right now we haven't seen this, right? But it's at the point when vaccinated people who are fully vaccinated and therefore have full immunity, if they start getting ill, and we determine that the reason for these cases of severe illness are due to new variants that may somehow evade the immunity being given by the vaccines that we currently have. If we see examples of those types of breakthrough infections, that's when we know that we really need to get these booster shots out. But again, we don't have evidence of that yet. Good to prepare in the meantime. I would anticipate that if that were to occur, it wouldn't be for months, maybe even longer. But we don't know. And we may end up in a situation, again, I don't know that this is the case, but I think we do need to prepare for a situation that we may need to keep on getting regular boosters, for example, almost like an annual flu shot, if we end up keeping on having these variants that evade our the existing vaccines, we may need to be developing boosters that continue to chase these variants.
And Dr. Nguyen, one of the reasons we have you on, among the many reasons we have you on, is so that we can clear up misconceptions and some perhaps some misinformation that folks have. And I suspect that this might be a case of that, although I could be wrong. So I want to pose this question from Lynn, who says, I received my first vaccination yesterday at a Walgreens and was given the AstraZeneca vaccine. I've heard about Moderna and Pfizer and J&J, but not AstraZeneca. When did it receive CDC approval? And Dr. Nguyen, my understanding is that it has not received CDC or FDA approval. It's been approved by the World Health Organization, but the company has not even applied for approval, saying that it needs to finish its phase three clinical trials. What can you tell us about AstraZeneca? And it seems that if it hasn't been approved, it's unlikely that Lynn actually did receive the AstraZeneca vaccine. Is that right?
Correct. So there is no chance that Lynn received the AstraZeneca vaccine in the U.S. unless it's in the context of a clinical trial. The AstraZeneca vaccine is another vaccine, another two-dose vaccine, viral vector vaccine that is being studied by Oxford University and AstraZeneca. It has already been approved for use in several other countries, including the UK, throughout the European Union. It's being given out and is a vaccine that is actively undergoing investigation here in the US. And so people who are in a vaccine trial are certainly getting the AstraZeneca vaccine, but it has not been, even as you said, Tom, the authorization has not even been submitted to the FDA. The FDA certainly has not authorized this. The CDC has not recommended this. And so the only vaccines right now that are authorized in the U.S. are the three, the Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. We will expect that the AstraZeneca vaccine probably is going to be submitted for authorization. Novavax is another one that probably is going to be submitted for authorization in the months to come, but it has not yet.
Cyril emails, when will it save, under what circumstances will it be safe to travel?
Great question. And actually, it allows me the opportunity to talk about one issue that I feel very passionately about, which is the advice that we can give to fully vaccinated people. I know that's not quite Cyril's question, which I will definitely talk about as well. But
yeah,
I think
that is definitely a question a lot of folks need to know about, because, you know, if people have been vaccinated, you know, what's allowed, what's not allowed, and travel would be perhaps one of those things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And in fact, I think that we in the medical and public health community really do a disservice to our patients if we cannot provide clear guidance about what kind of activities people can resume once they're fully vaccinated. Right now, the CDC guidelines, I think, are not sufficient, because they basically say, once you're fully vaccinated, you have to do exactly the same thing that you did pre-vaccination. That's not appropriate. It's not common sense. And people are just not going to do it. I mean, when I say this to my patients, I get one of two responses. I have some patients say, forget about it. That doesn't make sense. I'm vaccinated. I'm protected. I'm ripping up my mask and going about my usual life. That's not great. Because at this moment, we don't know the full answer to the question of, if you're vaccinated, can you still be potentially infecting others? As in, you're protected yourself, but could you be infecting others? We think that there's pretty good evidence that you have a much reduced likelihood of infecting others, but there's still a chance. So ripping off your mask, going bar hopping, not a great idea. But I also don't think that we can tell people, continue to live as you did before, because otherwise people are not going to see the point of getting the vaccine. And so to Cyril's question, I think that people can, first of all, I think if there's anything essential that you've been putting off, so if you have not gone and done colonoscopies and mammograms, and if you've been putting off your elective surgeries, you should do that right now because you are well protected. I also think that travel was pretty safe before, and now you should keep on wearing a mask while you're traveling. But let's say that you've been putting off a trip to see your grandkids because of fear for you, as in you, the concern was not so much about everybody else. The concern was you as an older individual with medical conditions, let's say, that the other members of the family might infect you. Now that you are fully vaccinated, so it's been, you get both doses of Pfizer, Moderna, or the one dose of Johnson & Johnson, and it's been at least 2 weeks, you should feel free, I think, to travel and see your loved ones. Still continue to use precautions while in public, but I think that that is a risk worth taking, relatively very low risk, and I think people are feeling really isolated, and we need to be able to give them some hope for, and some sense of the normality that will come with vaccination.
Let's go to the phones to Karen, who's calling from Baltimore. Karen, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Doing great.
Good, good. Well, I'm feeling extremely grateful today because I just spoke to my parents in California. They're very elderly. Dad is 92. Mom is 87. They should live and be well. They both got their second shots over the weekend. They both did fine. And a year ago, I was still working as an oncology nurse at Hopkins, and I was extremely apprehensive about the situation. I chose to take early retirement because I was turning 64 and now on the verge of turning 65. And I am just so incredibly, incredibly grateful that I will, you know, I live to see all this, you know, this kind of difficult year, but this, I think, good outcome. And I will take any shot they offer me. Actually, at this point, I'm not quite eligible because I'm really in group or phase two or whatever it is because of my age and I'm not working and I don't have comorbidities. But if it becomes available and they offer me the Johnson & Johnson, I will take that. It's one shot. I could go home in 2 weeks, you know, after I get the shot. But if they offer me the other ones, I'll take those. You know, I've learned enough, and I think the efficacy is amazing because you really just don't want to get real sick and end up in the hospital and worse. And
that's
from what I'm
sure.
Understanding, I heard Dr. Fauci and two doctors on the 10 o'clock show, and it just echoes everything I've heard that, you know, this is a wonderful thing that we have this third vaccine. And the one shot and the no crazy, you know, extreme freezers and all that. I mean, this
sure.
is just amazing. It all happened
yeah.
in a year.
Okay. Well, Karen, thank you for that call. I appreciate the perspective. And Lena, the issue of who is prioritized for the vaccine and who's not so far, is another thing you've written about, particularly in regard to whether or not we should open schools. Today, the Baltimore City school system is opening its doors back up to kindergarten, first and second graders. They're going to add third through fifth graders in the middle of the month. And they're gradually trying to get people back into school buildings. A lot of controversy about that. And in your piece in the Washington Post, you said that the whole controversy on both sides, people who think schools should be open and others who think they should wait until more teachers are vaccinated in particular, both sides are getting it wrong. What are folks missing in that debate?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a difficult issue and one that I have so much sympathy for people on every side of this. And there's something that I've come to see, Tom, which is that we are never going to agree. The two sides are never going to agree if what we have to agree on is whether schools are safe, because people just have such different tolerance of risk. Some people will say, hey, if your likelihood of getting coronavirus in a school is less than your likelihood of getting coronavirus elsewhere in the community, that makes it safe. Some other people will say, but I'm choosing to work, let's say for a teacher, I'm choosing to work entirely from home. You can't tell me that going to an in-person school with 20 kids will be just as safe as working from home. That's clearly not the case. And so that's not safe. If some people say, well, you need zero risk. Others say there's no chance of getting to zero risk. And so I think that we need to completely reframe this. I think we should be reframing at this point, a year into the pandemic, we should be asking ourselves, are schools essential? And if they are essential, which I would hope that most of us would recognize that they are, if that's the case, we need to look at schools the way that we look at doctor's offices, which is that we understand that they are not 100% safe, that there will be instances, could be instances, where there is transmission in school. Certainly, there'll be instances where people go to these doctor's offices or to these schools, and there will be people who have coronavirus. We want to reduce the risk of in-school transmission as much as possible, understanding that we may never get the risk to 0.000. We need to get it to be as safe as possible. But in the meantime, because of how essential they are, that's why we need to get schools open, so that parents should be sending their kids to school, not because they are 100% safe, but even in spite of them not being 100% safe because of the cognitive behavioral deficits that are accumulating, because of the educational disparities that are occurring, because of the lack of technology, because of Zoom fatigue, because of mental health issues, because parents need to work. I mean, I think that if we reframe it around how essential schools are, then we should also look at what kinds of investments we need to be making in the schools, investments in upgrades, for example, on HVAC systems and ventilation, but also very critically, getting teachers vaccinated. Because we said initially at the beginning of this, at the beginning of vaccinations, healthcare workers need to be vaccinated first because they are essential. I think we should be seeing teachers, and not just teachers, but all school staff, the same way. For too long, we have prioritized other things over our children. We have had bars open and not schools. I think it's time for us to say, kids, children, schools, top priority. If that's the case, then we should be making sure that we are protecting the teachers and staff who work in them.
Yeah, you make a really good point in that column in the Washington Post that, you know, if we think of schools as essential the way we think of hospitals as essential, and you say, you know, we didn't shut down the hospitals until all the doctors and nurses and hospital personnel were vaccinated. We're not doing that with schools either, but we need to move teachers to the front of the line. The Biden administration has said they think teachers should be prioritized, but it's up to the states. And that, of course, then opens up all sorts of possibilities of them not being actually prioritized. We'll talk more about this on the other side of a quick break with former Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. She's an emergency physician, a visiting professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health. She's a columnist for the Washington Post and a commentator on CNN. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. And before we go to a break, each week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City. We also post their names on our webpage, and we do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from a researcher named Ellen Worthing, the Baltimore Sun, and the Baltimore Police Department. So far this year, 44 people have been victims of homicide in Baltimore. Last week, police reported 4 people were victims of homicide. They are Todd Fitzgerald, age 22, Sean Horton, age 41, Melvin Hairston, age 33, and Stephanie Chandler. She was 57 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Wen is a physician and public health professor at George Washington University. She writes a column for the Washington Post. She's a medical analyst and commentator on CNN, and she is one of the leading public health experts in the world. 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org to tweet us. It's at midday WYPR. So, Lena, we have a couple of questions about people who have been vaccinated and people who've had COVID and whether they should get vaccinated. Ellen says, is it possible for vaccinated people to become infected? And Lisa asks, I had COVID, but I went ahead and got the vaccination. Is that okay?
The short answer is definitely you should get the vaccine, even if you have had COVID already. And that's because the vaccine gives you more consistent protection. Maybe it even gives you longer lasting protection. We don't know, but it definitely gives you more consistent protection. Interestingly, the CDC has actually revised their guidance on this several times, which is understandable because this is an evolving situation. We're learning more every day. The CDC is now saying that if you've recently had coronavirus, it's certainly safe to get the vaccine, but you may want to wait and let others perhaps go first while there is a limited supply. So I would say if you had coronavirus in the last 90 days, maybe consider waiting until at least 90 days, not because it's somehow unsafe for you, but rather because we have such limited supply. Almost certainly you have a pretty good protection for at least 90 days. Reinfection is theoretically possible. It is very rare. What's concerning about reinfection actually is that there have been cases of reinfection with the variant first identified in South Africa, the B1351 variant, the variant first identified in Brazil, the P1 variant. And some of these variants look as if they may cause reinfection. But again, even if you've had coronavirus or have had the vaccine, you probably have some level of protection even against these emerging variants too.
Homer sends us an email. How can we reach herd immunity with the vaccine if it has not yet been proven that the vaccine stops transmission of the virus?
Yeah, it's a reasonable question. I think here's what we can say about herd immunity. First is that I think there is a misconception that herd immunity is like a light switch, that there is a magic number that we get to. And on that day, the bells all go ringing and we can all celebrate and take off our masks. It's not quite like that. It's rather that the more immunity we have around us, the more people either have immunity through infection or through vaccination, the less the virus is able to spread. And so as people get vaccinated much more coming into the spring and summer, I believe we will see a substantial decline in the number of new infections just because the virus has nowhere else to go. And so at some point, ideally, we reach a point of having so much immunity that the virus really has nowhere to go and end up stopping. That's the point of herd immunity. It is a point that we don't fully know whether people who are vaccinated will still be able to transmit the virus to others. But again, there is growing evidence that that's probably the case. Based on what we can see now with preliminary evidence from Israel, where the Pfizer vaccine has gone out to a large percentage of the population, we are seeing that the people who are newly infected is substantially declining. There's also some evidence in the Moderna and the Johnson & Johnson data suggesting that there are fewer asymptomatic infections in people who are fully vaccinated. So I think there's just growing evidence that probably fully vaccinated people are also less likely to transmit the virus, although we don't have enough for us to say you can just go out and take off your mask as soon as you're done.
This email from Lisa sounds like it's probably pretty good advice. She says, I've been helping several seniors without internet make COVID vaccine appointments. We agreed to having me fill out their forms since they don't use email or cell phones. So I gave my personal info so that I could respond quickly. In other words, it sounds like Lisa's giving her email address and phone number so that she can be texted or emailed about when appointments are available. So she says, since you need to respond ASAP to grab an appointment when a text comes through, I kept their legal name, full address, and birth date handy so that I could respond as if I were them. She says it worked. However, since the first time I didn't have it, it took me a few minutes to call somebody and find that information. And by the time she went back to sign up, within 3 or 4 minutes, the appointments were gone. So if you're helping folks find a vaccine appointment, keep that list of information handy so that you can sign up right away. That's good advice from Lisa, I think. Let's go to Carrie, who's calling from Catonsville. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
Hi, Dr. Nguyen. I was just wondering if you have an update on the impact of getting the vaccine for nursing mothers.
That's a great question, and I just wanted to remark also on the last person, on Lisa, and to thank Lisa and to thank all those individuals who are helping others navigate this process, because, again, we know that it's very cumbersome, really clunky, really confusing to people who have full access to the internet and every technology, and so having individuals who can help others who may not have such access, really want to thank people for doing that. So the question that Carrie asked is a really good one, because the initial vaccine trials did not involve pregnant or breastfeeding individuals. And so we cannot say for certain that it is safe for pregnant and breastfeeding women. However, here's what we can say, specifically to the question that Carrie asked, which is for nursing moms. This is a vaccine. These all three, actually all the vaccines that we're talking about, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, they all do not contain live virus. So there is no reason to believe that there is any physiological impediment. There's no physiological reason as to why the vaccines would cause any harm to the mom, to the baby, et cetera. And so any risk would be purely theoretical. And I think, you know, you have to think about the risk in this case of contracting coronavirus and potentially infecting a newborn and others around you too. And so since the vaccines were first authorized, even though they were not specifically authorized for pregnant and breastfeeding individuals, tens of thousands of pregnant and breastfeeding people have taken the vaccine, and there have been no substantial adverse reaction that's reported. And so I would certainly ask and hope that every person is able to make that decision for themselves. But again, understanding the theoretical risk is very different from, I think, the very real risk of contracting COVID-19 and having a substantial adverse outcome.
We have another caller with a question about babies. David from Pikesville, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen. What's your quick question?
Well, can't you pass the virus onto the baby if you handle the baby without a mask?
Yes. So this is exactly what I was referring to, that we know that pregnant and breastfeeding individuals have higher risk. So pregnant women, as an example, are more likely to become severely ill than non-pregnant people. And also nursing moms, they'll probably have young children, young babies that may not have much of an immune system themselves. And so this is why protecting the individual, protecting the pregnant woman, the nursing woman, et cetera, is really important, because it also protects the baby and those around them too.
And for other people who are handling the baby, maybe a good idea for them to wear a mask?
Well, I would certainly encourage for people with newborns, as I had, my baby now is almost 11 months old, but I would certainly encourage for people to not associate with those who are not in their immediate household. And so keep to your own pandemic pod. And if somebody else, for some reason, is taking care of the baby who is not in their pod, to absolutely wear a mask and to keep every hand washing, hygiene, and other types of precautions.
Let's go to Brenda, who's calling from Eldersburg. Welcome to Midday. What's your quick question for Dr. Nguyen?
Hi, Dr. Nguyen, and thank you, Tom, both of you, very much. I have cystic fibrosis. I'm 71. My maid has... He has severe heart problems, and I've diabetes for over 51 years, and we can't get it anywhere. I mean, we're both 71. We've tried. Philip was up 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, and I've been calling through the night. I've been calling, and three other people are trying to help us out, who are not in the medical field, but they're trying so hard. One in Montgomery County, I don't even know him from Facebook. She's trying to help me.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, Brenda. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we've got just a couple of minutes left. But I think your problem is a problem that a lot of people are having. And Dr. Nguyen, the governor has said that they thought about having a centralized website, a centralized system for assigning appointments around the state, decided against that. At this juncture in the pandemic, as a public health expert, are there tweaks to the system that we currently have that we should be implementing immediately to fix the problem that Brenda is talking about? So many people are so frustrated in their attempts to get an appointment for a vaccine.
Yeah, I hear Brenda's frustration. I certainly hear from so many other people too. The only thing that I can say that I hopefully can help is that it is going to improve. That at some point, pretty soon, we are going to have much more supply. We are going to have much more sites of distribution, so that maybe regular doctor's offices and clinics and more pharmacies will be able to offer it too. And I think having additional access points will be really important. I hope that what Governor Hogan can do, in addition to having more transparency around who's getting the vaccine, I think also there can be much more visibility in advance of who is eligible. The eligibility is going to open up in Maryland soon, and I don't think that that's been announced quite yet. I also think that a lot more needs to be done to increase the sites of distribution, including to areas that are the hardest hit for the most vulnerable individuals. And I hope that that goal, that commitment to equity, is something that our governor, as well as policymakers all around the country, really need to set as a primary goal.
Quick question. We got 20 seconds left from a caller who says, can vaccinated people dine indoors together safely?
If there are two couples and everybody in those couples, let's say that in those family units, if everybody is fully vaccinated and it's been at least 2 weeks, I do think that it's safe for them to see one another indoors without masks and to have dinner together.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is a former Baltimore City Health Commissioner, and we'll have a link to her essays in the Washington Post on our website, wypr.org/midday. Lena, thank you as always. We really appreciate your erudition and perspective. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, an update from Annapolis. Republican Minority Leader Delegate Nick Kipke and Delegate Kathy Shalaga, the Minority Whip, will join me, along with Evita Wiggins, of the Washington Post. We'll have a conversation about Republican priorities in this year's General Assembly session and an overview of what the legislature has accomplished so far. That's coming up tomorrow. Stay tuned now for Here and Now. That's on the way at the top of the hour. And later, be sure to download WYPR's podcast, The Daily Dose. Our director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. Rob Sivak is our senior producer. Jamila Krimple is WYPR's digital content director. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the midday theme music. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day. We will talk again tomorrow.
You're listening to your NPR News station, 88.1 WYPR.